So I just want to some extent, continue from what Stas was saying. And then, unfortunately, what I would like to do is move on to the sort of more nonlinear regime. And then when you do that, instead of having this nice analytical results that you know exactly what you're doing, you just go into the realm of wild speculation, because nobody can really deal with nonlinear systems very easily. And in particular, I want to address some of the issues that concern this vexing problem of how do you generate large-scale field. I mean, the point of one of the messages from the previous talk from Stas is that even if you have a helical system and you try to convince this thing to generate a large-scale field, it looks as if what the system wants to do is just generate a lot of small-scale fluctuations very, very quickly, rather than generate a large-scale field very slowly. And this seems to have been borne out by many of the numerical simulations that people try to do, that when you do the simulation at low magnetic Reynolds number, they behave in a nice, smooth way, they produce a nice, large-scale field, and they do everything you want. And then when you push them to higher and higher Reynolds number, and you think, you know, you should be doing better and better because you're becoming more realistic, you're going towards the astrophysically relevant regime of very high magnetic Reynolds number, all that happens is that things get worse and worse and worse and worse, and everything gets controlled by small-scale fluctuations, and you never seem to see very naturally an organized magnetic field that emerges, although it does in some cases. And so I guess the theme of this talk is to try to figure out why it is that sometimes you can get an organized field, but most of the times you don't, okay? And kinematically, I think we've figured it out. Kinematically is very much what Stas was talking about, is that the growth rate of the fluctuations always exceeds the growth rate of the large-scale structures. Anyway, so this is, you know, typical introductory slide, you know, magnetic fields on all possible scales, you know, they go from meters to kiloparsecs, hundreds of kiloparsecs. This isn't surprising at all, given the previous talk, which tells you that, you know, if you have high magnetic Reynolds number, and in astrophysics you always have high magnetic Reynolds number, you can magnetize anything. So no wonder that everything is magnetized. It all kind of hangs together. What is more surprising and more difficult to explain is why it is that, you know, in astrophysics you have so many large-scale fields that are so coherent and strong over such enormous distances. And that is, I would say, the problem in dynamo theory at the moment. It's just that, at least I would say personally, we don't seem to have a very good understanding of how we organize these fields on this enormous scale. So if you want to be more technical, more, I don't know, precise, you could say, okay, there are two problems that are related. One is how you generate magnetic energy, and the other one is how you generate magnetic flux, okay? So magnetic energy, you could say, is what most people would call the small-scale dynamo problem, and the generation of magnetic flux is what most people would call the large-scale dynamo problem. And the difficulty is in generating flux, not energy. Energy, everybody agrees, it's easy to do. Of course, you have to introduce a scale, because otherwise you don't know what you're integrating with respect. So in your head, think that the scale, the relevant scale, is, let's say, the velocity correlation length. So you want to have flux on scales that are substantially larger than the velocity correlation. Now, the general wisdom, which, you know, this is what we're having problems with, used to be that if you have reflectionally symmetric turbulence, you can generate all the energy you want. And the other wisdom was that if you had reflectionally non-symmetric turbulence, like you had helicity or some kind of, you know, lack of reflectional symmetry, even though it may not have been helicity, but something that made the system non-reflectionally symmetric, then somehow you could generate magnetic flux. And this is such an attractive mechanism that everybody loves it, because it gives you this universal method of solving all your problems. It is like, you know, it works no matter what. All you need is lack of reflectional symmetry, and then some kind of inverse cascade will take care of everything and generate these large-scale organized fields. So it would be great if it were true. But it seems that in many cases it's not. And so that's a problem. Why is it that sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, and in many, many cases it does not? So again, before we looked at what the problem is kinematically, the problem kinematically is that at least in the few cases in which things can be carried through analytically, The thing that seems to break down is that you cannot guarantee a separation of scale. All right? Maybe one thing that should be pointed out about what Stas was talking about is that all of those energy levels that you saw were not eigenfunctions for B. They were eigenfunctions for the correlator of B. So really, the only meaningful state in that system is the fastest growing one. Okay? So really, asymptotically, you only see the bound state, the one with the maximum growth rate. You never see the other one. All right? They weren't states for B. They were states for the correlator of B. All right. So yeah, then the question is, can we maybe circumvent some of these problems by having nonlinear effects? You know, now we have the Lorentz force. Can it do something for us that will help us organize these fields? Of course, something has to do it because we see the field. So something has to work. It's just like, you know, can we pin down what it is? And pin down here means, can we figure out what it is that we have to make, we have to put in our numerical models or analytic models so that we can get some understanding of how large-scale fields are generated in the universe. This is the level at which one would like to proceed, so that we can actually get things done. And we used to think that it was elicited. We used to think, like, just bunk some elicited in there and everything will work, but it seems that that's not always enough. In fact, it's almost never enough. Anyway, so this business on nonlinear effects, and so this is non-standard. This was introduced last night when I wrote this talk. So I didn't know how to call these two possible approaches to nonlinear things, so let's call them quasi-kinematic and essentially nonlinear. So quasi-kinematics is what we normally do, which is you assume that the initial field is very, very weak, so you have a velocity that is given. That's a kinematic problem. You solve that, which is easy to solve because it's linear. This is what everybody has been doing for the last 40 years or so. The Kazantsev model is an example of that. You figure out what's going on, and you always end up with an exponentially growing solution, and then you argue that at some point the Lorentz force will become sufficiently important that it modifies the field, and something nonlinear is going to happen, and the growth will cease. It will saturate, and there you go. Okay? In this scenario, whatever they call approach, the role of nonlinear interaction is to saturate an exponential growth. So what it does is that it prevents this thing from going off growing forever and ever. Okay? And some systems definitely work like that. That's exactly what they do. You can also conceive of a slightly different case, or actually completely different case, in which, you know, the velocity that drives the dynamo process is due to magnetic instabilities or some magnetic effect. So it's a velocity that would not be there in the first place had you not had a magnetic field to drive it. This, for instance, is the case in the RFP. If you remember the talk yesterday by, you know, the fictitious Stuart Prager, heavily disguised as Kerry Forrest, in that talk, if you don't have the magnetic field, you never get the tearing mode instabilities, you never get the velocity, you never get this induction effect. So in that case, you don't have a kinematic regime. You don't have any, you know, you don't have any a priori velocity that you can linearize about, because the very velocity requires the magnetic field. Nevertheless, I mean, those are, physically speaking, perfectly legitimate dynamo systems, but they can't be analyzed in this technique, because otherwise you don't know what velocity to put in there. There's no kinematic phase. And the nonlinearity in this saturation is a complicated mess because, you know, you're trying to figure out who's saturating whom when each one is pushing the other. So these are relatively simple to analyze, and that's why we haven't analyzed a lot of those systems. And these are horrible to analyze, and that's why we don't know much about them. But if I were to argue one thing, I would like to argue that we probably have better chance of producing organized fields with these things than we have with those things. Maybe this isn't true, but this is what I'm going to argue anyway. Okay, so this is the idea, is that maybe what we should start looking at in earnest are these essentially nonlinear dynamos. Okay, so let me have a look at this business of saturation for a small-scale dynamo. So these are the ones that saturate type 1. And I don't think it makes much difference which one you pick. Just pick anything you want, and I just picked the one of a dynamo, small-scale dynamo driven by non-rotating convection. So imagine that you have a box, you have convection in it because you're heating the bottom and cooling the top. This thing will convect, and so this is time going along here in units of the thermal relaxation time. So here, one unit of time corresponds to an awful lot of turnovers, many turnovers. And so this is the time trace of the kinetic energy. So this is in a stationary state where it's just kind of rotating around. And at some epoch, you introduce a small seed field. These calculations were actually carried out by one of our organizers. So if they're wrong, it's his fault. And what happens is that this is on a linear scale. So the thing grows exponentially for a little bit, then it saturates, and then you reach this stationary state where everything bounces around, but the averages are well defined. Okay? And so the general wisdom is that obviously the presence of the magnetic field has somehow modified the velocity a little bit so that this thing doesn't keep growing exponentially forever. Okay. This is a quick question that Steve and I have been playing with over the last few weeks, which is the following. Well, if you go back from, let's say, this epoch on out, this is a perfectly sensible velocity field, okay? I mean, it's a velocity, it's defined, it's there, you know what it is. You can compute it, and it's a velocity. And then you say, well, take that velocity over there that I've just generated that way. What are the dynamo properties of that thing? I mean, it's a velocity, I can ask this question. If you want to be more pedantic and more precise, you say, okay, this is the recipe that I used to generate this velocity. I solved this equation with some forcing, Lorentz force, everything, these are nonlinear. I generate this velocity field, which of course is what you would call a saturated dynamo. Eventually this thing saturates, you now have a velocity, it's sitting there. You take this velocity and you stick it into the induction equation for another vector field, which is not B, okay? And then you ask, is this thing sitting in this equation now, is that a dynamo? And what kind of dynamo is it? All right, that's a simple question. Now, you say, well, it depends. Clearly, if at some instant Z is aligned with B, then they would be aligned forever because they solve exactly the same equation. Much like Stas was saying earlier, it's the same thing with the vorticity, and therefore it will not grow. So you would conclude that U is definitely a marginal dynamo with respect to any other vector field which is aligned with B. What about with fields that are not aligned with B? So some other vector field, all right? Well, okay, how many of you think this thing is a dynamo? How many of you think that it's not a dynamo? I mean, it's a marginal dynamo. All right. Zero growth rate. You see, with respect to B, it has zero growth rate. I mean, B just kind of, it's marginal. It has marginal growth. All right, so here we go. This is B, and this is Z. And Steve tells me, and I believe him, that it doesn't matter what you choose, so long as you don't choose an initial conditions where your field is aligned with B, you always get this thing to grow exponentially. Notice that now we've gone to a sort of, this is a log linear plot, so a straight line in this is an exponential growth, and this is like 8 orders of magnitude. All right? So this is bizarre. Maybe it's not bizarre, but I mean, it is to us. This velocity that you've obtained by saturating this dynamo saturates B, but absolutely no other vector field. Any other vector field? Right. So you were one of those that put up your hand saying, oh. So this is one of those things that it's obvious when it is. It becomes obvious as soon as you realize that it's obvious. Okay, so if you keep, this is a linear equation, so this will just keep growing exponentially forever. And that's it. So it's just, it will grow exponentially and then just keep growing and growing, and eventually your computer exceeds whatever it can keep in there. Interestingly enough, this is also true of shell models. That, you know, Steve and I were convinced it wouldn't work for shell models because we convinced ourselves that the way this thing saturates, of course, it has to do with some very sophisticated correlations which are introduced by the Lorentz force, and therefore we thought, if you shell average like you do in shell models, this thing ain't gonna do it for, you know, if it saturates one magnetic field, it should saturate them all, because in a shell model, right, that it's only all of the information of the magnetic field that represented just by the sequence of coefficients on the shells. It can't possibly have all the richness of the actual field. It turns out this is also true for shell models. Okay, so even for shell models, it turns out that the only things that saturates is B. All other vector fields grow exponentially. Okay?
But the two equations are unique.
I'm sorry?
In other words, the two equations, when you have two, are unique to me.
Maybe you can think of it that way, but okay, well, that's... Right, so two things that can be said are the following. First of all, the way that a dynamo saturates is drastically different from the way that, say, shear-driven instability saturates, or convective instability saturates. The way they saturate is by modifying the mean field until the mean field is near marginal and nothing will grow exponentially. The way that these guys do it is by introducing these very sneaky correlations that only work for the magnetic field and absolutely nothing else. And the velocity is not being brought back to near marginal. It's just marginal for that one vector field. The way I think about it, which may be a completely ridiculous way to think about it, but here it is anyway, is that if you think about the, you know, Cauchy solution for the magnetic field, you can write that the magnetic field here and now is what it used to be at some earlier time, multiplied by the Jacobian along the trajectory between where you are and the pre-image of where you are. So this is just, you know, exact. Now, if you actually try to figure out what this Jacobian is, it's well approximated by the time-ordered product of these exponential matrices. So the transformation between what the field used to be and what the field is now is just this object that can be represented by a sequence of multiplications of exponential matrices. All of these matrices have unit determinant. Okay? So the funny thing is that the first thing they teach you when you study products of random matrices with unit determinant is that the eigenvalues of the product grows exponentially with, you know, however many you multiply. This is like this is actually how you define Lyapunov exponents. The rate of growth of those things is the Lyapunov exponent. So if you have a bunch of random matrices, you multiply them all together, the eigenvalues grow exponentially, which corresponds to dynamo action. It means that, you know, you put in your little field at the beginning and this thing grows exponentially. So if it doesn't, which is what we're talking about, it's like saying that this time-ordered product of non-commuting matrix is a very specific, you know, sequence of matrices, the very specific matrix sequence that whose eigenvalues don't grow exponentially. All right? So the effect of the Lorentz force is to take a sequence of matrix that if you were to multiply them in some random way would grow exponentially and reorder them in such a clever way that with respect to that field, they won't grow, but they will grow with respect to any other field. So any other field would correspond to not multiplying them in the time-ordered way, but in any other way, okay? So I don't know if this helps you or anybody else think about what this thing is doing, but the bottom line is the following, is that if you take a saturated small-scale dynamo, it's still a small-scale dynamo, kinematically speaking. So this, I don't know if this helps answer the question that you were asking, which is, what happens if you have a small scale and it saturates and it's still helical and it still has induction? Will the large scale grow on top of that thing? God knows. But what you know is that this new flow that you've generated by saturating the small scale is still a small scale dynamo. And therefore, if I take it and stuff it into the Kazantsev model, I get exactly the same thing that I had before, which is the no scale separation, and the thing that grows fastest are the small scale dynamos. Okay? So So there, I mean, you know, this is sneaky. These things have these funny correlations that only work for the magnetic field. And this hope of getting away with it by saying the small-scale dynamo will saturate, but the resulting flow is helical, and therefore it will generate the growth of large-scale field by a method that can analyze kinematically, like mean field theory, is not going to work. So the large-scale field may well grow, but if it does so, it will be by a very sneaky nonlinear process and not by a non-sneaky kinematic one. Okay? So the hope of getting out of this mess easily, I think it has to be reviewed. It's not that we can't get out of the mess. Of course we can. But it has to be a nonlinear theory. It has to be a very nonlinear theory. A theory that it's not easily attached to a kinematic process by just saying, well, it's like a kinematic process, then I just change it a little bit. You have to change it a heck of a lot. All right. So I go till what? So quarter past, something like that? Okay. So in the next 8 minutes, so I thought we finished at 25 past, is that right? A quarter past, okay. So mean field theory. So now we're back to this problem that we have to generate large-scale field because we see it, and hopefully I will have, if not convinced you, at least made you think that this may be sneakier than we think. And of course, the quantity that we're trying to understand, because there's no way around it, if you take the induction equation and average over some large scale, the quantity that you get that has to, that affects the time rate of change of B on that large scale is this object here. It's the mean EMF on that scale. And so you think the only thing that I can hope that will give me what I want is that this thing behaves sensibly on the large scale, right? And the thing that everybody has been doing for the longest time, and you know, it's a great thing to do, is to try to understand this object by relating it through these two coefficients but to the mean field and its derivatives. And what this relationship is turning out to be more complicated than we thought. And I'm not going to have the time to go through, and also I don't need to, because Karl Heinz yesterday went through it in great details. He derived what equation you have to solve to get the fluctuations, this funny term here, which is the nonlinear one, and so forth and so on. So let me go quickly through one example that hopefully helps. This example actually is Moffat, and is what happens if you work it out for a single helical wave. So you just take one helical wave, you stick it into those equations, and you work out the mean EMF for that case. So that's a single helical wave. You can work out that it has positive helicity, and you can work out anything you want. This you can do analytically. You can solve it all the way through. And of course, the field, the fluctuating field that you get out of solving that equation that was up a second ago is divided into two parts. You know, this is the oscillatory part that has the same frequency as the helical wave plus another part that I need to satisfy the initial boundary condition, the initial conditions, and if you want, is the particular integral, right? This thing is a transient, it will decay with some decay rate that has to do with eta, and this is the sort of, you know, the thing that persists forever. So if you go through this exercise and you look at what the mean EMF looks like, it looks, you know, as if it has two contributions. This is the one from the steady state piece, and then there is another piece that decays away. Okay? So now you begin to see that even this case is sneaky. It's sneaky because if I want to look at the sort of long time small eta regime, I have to decide in advance which order I'm going to take these limits. So if I take the limit where I fix eta and I go to a very, very long time, I just get that the alpha is just proportional to eta and it's that number. I get a nice solution. Okay, the mean induction is a number, whatever the hell that number is. If I do it the other round, I just fix t and I let eta go to zero, basically what happens is that for any time I fix, I can make eta so small that the initial conditions have not been forgotten. And therefore, I find that the EMF is just an oscillatory function. It keeps on boom, boom, boom. So the order of these limits is very important and has to be done accordingly. So what can we say even from this simple example? Well, first of all, that the EMF is proportional to the helicity. Thank God everybody knew that. Great. It's also proportional to the diffusivity in this thing. And if you look at exactly how it happens, you realize that what the diffusivity does, it gives you a little bit of a phase shift between B and U so that this thing is non-zero. But it's essential that you have this little phase shift, okay? Because of course, if these are the same, U and B are the same, you're just gonna get zero. So you want to phase shift them a tiny bit. It's also true that this diffusivity is necessary for convergence, because if you plonk it equal to zero, this thing has infinite memory and it will remember these initial conditions forever and ever and ever, and it will just bounce up and down and never settle down. Okay? Finally, if you go through and you look what this G term was in the previous example, it was zero because U cross B was equal to the average of U cross B. Okay? So this is a process where the average and its fluctuations are basically the same. All right? And so, in a sense, this tells you all of the things that you need for this to work. All right? Right. So you think, okay, so that was oversimplified. And in reality, you don't have a single helical wave. You've got, you know, an infinite number of crazy eddies. You have that the correlation time is typically comparable to the turnover time. The magnetic Reynolds number is not of order 1, is enormous. And so you think, what do I make out of it so that it works? And the general thing that all of us, or some of us, I mean me certainly, have assumed for the longest time, is to say something like, we need diffusivity. Well, you know, the actual diffusivity is tiny, but the effective one is huge. So the effect of the turbulence is to make the effective diffusivity large, which is exactly what happens in hydrodynamic turbulence. That in the limit of zero viscosity, you still have that the correlation time is of order 1. It's also going to make the system strongly irreversible, same as in hydrodynamics. You know, it's not the viscosity that decorrelates hydrodynamics, it's the nonlinear interaction. They just scramble the third order moments and everything is fine. And somehow the system has to stay close to this, you know, first order smoothing approximation in the sense that the fluctuations and the mean can't be that different. So if I look at an event, you know, I see this little, you know, Keith Moffat-y thing with the loop going up and twisting. Understanding the event that gives rise to a little contribution to the alpha effect is the same as trying to understand the ensemble of billions of these events. Okay, and I think it's fair to say that lots of us thought that that's what happened. However, then when we checked, it typically turned out not to be true in many, many cases. And certainly in closed systems, it was horrible. You can construct many systems, realizable ones, where none of those things happen. And you run into all this trouble, so the turbulent alpha effect gets strongly nonlinearly separated, and that has to do with infinite memory. You have this painfully slow convergence in some system. In some cases, this thing, instead of having a turbulent value, it has a collisional value. And if for each one of those cases where horrible things go wrong, you go through and you try to analyze what went wrong, they're always to do with the fact that one of those assumptions that you needed is broken down. Either this thing generated infinite memory or became correlated or God knows what, it's turbulent, but somehow it doesn't mix. You know, all sorts of things. And they seem to be associated with the presence of enormous fluctuations and the fact that you've lost this irreversibility at high magnetic Reynolds number. So there are various programs that we as a community have implemented, and one which is very promising, and you know, we're lucky because two of the exponents are sitting on the front row that, you know, they've pursued very vigorously, is to try to recover, well, it's try to correct this mess by considering maybe open systems or systems in which somehow, well, that's the way I look at it. Maybe that's not the way that, you know, the two of you would actually express it, but I think fundamentally it's the same thing, is that you try to recover irreversibility by considering the flow of information maybe out of your system, okay? And And I think it's a very promising approach, and maybe that really is how some of these systems do it. They just kind of have this horrible problem of lack of irreversibility, and they just kick it out of the system. And then something will take care of it. All right? I mean, if you think about a coronal mass ejection, imagine what would happen if a coronal mass ejection was not an irreversible process. You'd be sitting here with plasmoids coming back onto the sun from the orbit of Pluto. They just go all the way out there, and then they come all the way back. You know, be absurd. So you know, possibly that's the sensible way to do it. And I'm just saying another possible way to do it is to go this, you know, just say, okay, guys, let's go completely nonlinear. And let's assume that the actual velocity that is driving these large-scale dynamos, or not even large-scale, but at least organized dynamos, they're not random velocities, but they're velocity that were very specifically chosen by magnetic instability. The useful way to think about it is that, well, is it here? Oh, okay, well, we're not gonna do any of these things because we're running out of time. We've run out of time. So the idea, okay, I need to go back a second. So I need the expression for the mini EMF, okay? So I know everybody, but it's nice to have it. It's this quantity here. In turbulence, this kinematic theory, right? This is a random function. And you think, why should this be correlated to that? I mean, if this is a random function and this is an uncorrelated random function, this is going to be zero no matter what you do. So something has to correlate B to U. And you think, well, you know what it is. It's the solution of the induction equation. This isn't just any old crazy vector field. This is the one that solves the induction equation. So even if it's random, even if it's uncorrelated initially, the fact that this thing has to follow the flow will build correlations into it so that eventually these two things will be correlated and this thing is non-zero. All right? However, as I say, if this is a turbulent flow, this doesn't seem to work so well. It's almost like saying at high magnetic Reynolds number, the induction equation is just not good enough to correlate those two vector fields. But you can do it another way. You can say, you give me this, whatever you want, and I stick it into the momentum equation, and the Lorentz force is going to drive a velocity, and that velocity is unbelievably well correlated with B because I've just driven it with, you know, with the magnetic field. It's a magnetically driven velocity. It's the result of an instability. It wouldn't even have been there if it weren't for B. And therefore, I can build this correlation in a slightly different way by saying, why don't we just consider the velocities that are magnetically correlated, magnetically driven by B? Okay, if you do that, there are cases in which this thing works. One of them you heard, and it's, you know, the reverse field pinch. In this case, you get these massive inductive events. And there are some other dynamos, which I don't have time to go with, that still exist that work very well. And the thing that have in common is the following. They're not turbulent in the classical sense of turbulence. Not even the RFP is that turbulent, really. The velocity is always driven by magnetic instabilities. It's not just some crazy velocity that you put in a priori. No, it's... And the correlations between fluctuating U and fluctuating B arise from the induction, they arise from the dynamics. They're driven by forces, not by the induction equation. And they're all strongly irreversible. So I think maybe the way to think about this system and pursue them to hope to get something large scale is to look at systems that the actual velocity is maybe a mixture of turbulence, because that certainly is there, but where there is some organized flow that is very, very special and is driven by magnetic instabilities, like magnetic buoyancy or tearing modes or who knows what. And there's no reason to believe that in the actual sort of cases in the universe where you see large-scale fields, such instabilities wouldn't exist. So my plan would be, let's try to find some system, crazy though they may be, that work, and then we try to understand why they work and see if we can figure it out. Thanks. Oh, come on, 5 minutes to spare.
Minutes for questions.
Well, this question is regarding the saturated small-scale Dynamo.
Right.
Other Z field that grows exponentially, it does it just because it doesn't obey the induction equation?
It grows exponentially because it obeys the, it satisfies this equation here.
It's got no Lorentz force. Right?
It's got no Lorentz force.
So in a sense, it's not surprising that it's not.
Well, did you put your hand up?
No.
It's as surprising as that. I mean, you know, we had a bet, and we kept going back and forth and back and forth, and we agonized over this thing. And for the longest time, I was convinced that if you saturate one thing, you saturate everything. And it's not true. But there is a Lorentz force. There is a Lorentz force that defines you. Right. Yeah. But it's nothing to do with the spectrum. But you can find velocity that have. I mean, because Ansett model tells you that if you have a spectrum which is pretty flat, it's very hard to drive a dynamo. No, this thing doesn't change the spectrum at all. I mean, it doesn't do it by modifying the spectrum or anything. It doesn't do it by introducing some big integrated change in the velocity.
Yeah, so this is the
point that... You know, all of those things are true. It's just the use of, it's no surprise that. I mean, it's so no surprise that none of us could get it right.
Fausto, is the field Z that grows most rapidly
Most rapidly.
Well, the one that you showed us, this exponentially growing field,
right.
Is it related or correlated with the B?
Okay.
That
so what we believe at the moment is that if you take the box of all possible initial conditions, all right, then the set that doesn't grow is measure zero, and of course it contains B, but all other flows. So I think you really have to align it everywhere. If you misalign it, even in a tiny bit, because the induction equation is linear, split it into the align and an align bit. The align bit doesn't grow. The other one grows exponentially. You always end up with an exponentially growing field. So I really think that it's only B that doesn't grow.
So this is a related question. Since the induction equation is linear, is there some physical reality to think about Z as a small field which is going to grow up and start to compete with the one that you started with, or is there a circular reason?
No, exactly. That I would use it as an argument. That such argument doesn't make any sense. Because there's only one magnetic field, and that is saturated. Anything else you can put in there will grow exponentially. Yeah. So if you put the gradient of a scalar, it'll grow exponentially. Well, yeah, it will. Yeah, in the absence of eta, then it will quit. Otherwise, you have a scalar dynamo.
So in your talk, you considered only models that are local in space and time as mean field models. So what do you think about some models that are non-local to just consider correlations better of U and B?
I think that's a very, very worthwhile thing to do, I think. I think one should. I don't know how, but if anybody knows how. Yeah, I think that I think the correlations between these two vector fields is the key.
All right, this is back to the, I didn't understand. Where you get U of X and T from when you integrate the induction equation? You're just sort of backtracking and...
No, I just solved this.
Yeah, but you need a U of T in there. Where does that come from?
I just integrate this for a long time.
You're only pointing at the induction equation now.
These two.
Oh, both of them.
So I solve all three of them together.
Okay, and Z doesn't appear in J cross B.
No, that's the old point. I mean, this is curl of B, not curl of Z. If I swap them around, then this one will start to grow exponentially, and this will become stationary.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I have a question. Maybe Dave Galloway will not be happy because I am taking his question. Is the saturated state such that U is parallel to B or not at all?
Oh, you mean these things?
Yes.
No, these are very non. These are no. They're not Arcontis dynamo. At least not for convection. They're just like, you know, convection. You've got these cells and little tubes and a mass, and they're very non-aligned. But you see, the Arcontis dynamo is an example of a non-linear thing that is very well organized, where there is some amazing correlation between U and B. Hell, I mean, how correlated you want them, they're the same. So you couldn't ask for anything better than that.
Just a comment, first of all, regarding this issue here. I don't think that's necessarily something we have to worry about in practical terms, because we will always end up with magnetic fields that will saturate near the equipartition level. So if you're thinking of any large-scale dynamo, okay, there will be a small-scale dynamo running side by side to it, and it will saturate at equipartition level. Regarding the going fully nonlinear issue, there's still the issue of magnetic helicity conservation. So even if you drive your induction equation with a current in the induction equation, you will have a slow saturation in a closed system, resistively close saturation. And what you need to remove that is to have magnetic helicity fluxes out of the domain. And yeah. Those fluxes are being transported as usual, again, by contours along by contours of differential rotation. And so in all those cases, I think we will end up with a scenario that where the turbulence may either come through magnetic instabilities, as you're suggesting, or they may not come. And in any of those cases, the large-scale dynamo will work because of magnetic helicity fluxes.
So, I mean, you're saying this fault.
Yeah.
I agree. But, I mean, that's your talk.
Yeah, but you have also, but it applies also to the second item. It applies also to the second
probably
item.
Probably the reality is a mixture of both, I think. I mean, most things are open systems, and they're driven non-linearly, so probably both of them.
Can you go back to the slide that you had before?
Which one, Martin?
The one that you were just showing for some time. So is there anything to be learned from the other exercise? This means, you know, grabbing the... Yeah. Is there anything to be learned from the other exercise you could do? Grab the magnetic field, then a small b, and stick this into the momentum equation and look for a c field, which is not entirely u. So the opposite exercise of what you did.
I'm not sure I understood. Sorry.
So what you did here was to grab, you know, you solve for u and b, and then you stick to V and you look for a C field that satisfies something similar to the induction equation.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could do the opposite exercise now.
Okay.
Right?
You could grab. Swap them round.
No, now you grab the U field and look for a C field that satisfies the momentum equation.
Oh. No, I mean, I don't know. We haven't done. Have we done that? No.
No, I'm asking. No. Is there anything
to be
learned
from this? I don't know. Maybe, yeah. I have no idea.
So and see if. You know, if you get the same type of result, that only if the
right. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it's worth doing.
On that note, we probably